Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of February, a short month. Winter's almost over. We have all things political this hour and so much to talk about, concentrating a great deal on the economic stimulus bill and asking whether or not Republicans will come around, as President Obama believes they will, on this package, and a number of other issues to discuss. Two great guests with us. Matt Bai will join us the first half hour. He writes for the New York Times Magazine and has a piece in yesterday's magazine, which I'm sure you probably saw, Don't Look Back, Why Obama is Not FDR or Lincoln or Kennedy or History. Tina Brown will join us, founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and she'll be with us the second half hour of our program. She, in 92, was editor of The New Yorker, and she, for a few years now, has hosted CNBC's Topic A with Tina Brown. So she's going to be with us the second half hour. As always, your phone calls are welcome. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And you can send an email to us as well. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Matt Bai, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, Kathleen. How you feeling? How's everything?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good. It's February. Winter is almost over.
Well,
you've got
it worse there than we do. I'm not going to complain about winter. I know what it's like out there.
Yeah, but it's almost over. Yesterday's piece, if there is an especially useful historical parallel for what Obama seeks to achieve in these early weeks, it may not be right yesterday, Roosevelt or Kennedy or Lincoln, but Ronald Reagan. How so?
Well, I mean, if we're going to be throwing out every possible historical analogy to President Obama, you know, I actually think in a couple of ways, and I shorthanded it a bit in the piece. You know, I actually think the economic situation and the anxiety and the level of alarm, cause for alarm, is probably more analogous to the early 1980s than it was to the Great Depression. I mean, I'm not an economist, but I've seen the indicators and I've talked to people who know more about it than I do. And, you know, I think people forget how dire it felt in the early 1980s. When you had, you know, soaring inflation and interest rates, you know, well into the double digits, and an economy in recession, a tightening economy, and a tremendous lack of confidence both internationally and domestically, and the point I'm making here is that, you know, President Reagan succeeded in part by explaining the moment to people, that it wasn't just a question of having a legislative program, that you had to actually give people a sense of how they got there, the reassurance that you knew what had led to this, that there was a way out, and then to sort of put forth an agenda. I think he was helped in his political capital tremendously, really, by the assassination attempt in the first, you know, several weeks of his presidency, which I think gave him that approval rating, give you a lot of capital. But President Obama has a very high approval rating right now and majorities in Congress, which Reagan did not have. And I think he began in his inauguration speech and has since to lay out an explanation for people, a sense of what we have failed to do in the last 20 or 30 years, what led to this moment. And that, I think, does set the stage in a Reagan-like way for some tougher decisions if he wants to take that on.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this idea that's been given to us of Obama as a crisis president. He emerges at a dire moment. He rallies the nation to prevail. Is this a crisis moment in history, do you think?
Well, I absolutely, in American history, I absolutely think it's a crisis moment. How deep a crisis and how, you know, just how unprecedented it is another question. I mean, we all naturally believe, it's part of human nature, and like to believe that the moment we're facing is somehow anomalous and significant. And it is a significant moment. But, you know, I've heard President Obama say a couple of times in the last week, I get all the transcripts, and I've heard him say several times, we're living in unprecedented times. I don't think that's strictly true. I think if you look back at the situation in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt came into office and you had a quarter of the population unemployed, when you had when you have a gross income, national income, that had been halved in 3 or 4 years, that was mm-hmm. truly set a precedent that we've still not come close to approaching. And the nature of the problems now are different. So I think that's one way to see Obama as a crisis president. And then there's people who see him as sort of the hipster, Kennedy-style, generational president. And he himself has put forward a vision of himself as sort of the Lincolnian unifying figure. So there are a lot of analogies swirling around President Obama. And my only point is that while they're interesting and kind of helpful, and I do it myself, they can also limit us in the way we look at him and the way we look at our moment.
Right. The other thing he's been trying to do is bring all these people together, having, you know, in small ways, Super Bowl parties and cocktail parties and going to the Hill and meeting with Republican leaders, et cetera. Again, yesterday he said that he is confident that Republicans will come around. I must say, Matt, that I was a little surprised that there was not one vote in the House for the stimulus package. And word is, the last couple of days, that there probably won't be a vote in the Senate either. What's happened here with this bipartisan effort that he seems to have been working?
I had to laugh. I saw today in the Washington Post, Kathleen, the President Bush's first congressional relations director talking about what Obama's doing well and what he's not doing well. I mean, if we're going to take congressional relations advice from the Bush administration, we're going to be in an interesting situation.
Yeah.
I hardly think that's the authority on moving Congress. I think we're at the beginning of a process. First of all, I'm not sure that the Senate's going to actually do this without any Republican votes. I think that's very much an open question, how that works in the Senate. And I think there's a strategy behind this on the Republican side in the House, which is, they're trying really to contrast themselves with the Democratic leadership in the House. They're not looking to take on Obama right now. And they actually were, had great praise for him and preserved a pretty good working relationship. So, they decided to vote against that package in hopes of drawing a contrast, which was what they felt the Democrats in Congress were proposing, who have a much lower approval rating than the president. I don't know that that's a winning gambit, but it doesn't mean they won't work with the president. I actually think we're at the beginning of a process, and I don't think Obama's panicked about this. I mean, he has spent a tremendous amount of time in Capitol in the first couple weeks trying to build a relationship with Republicans. He starts in a better place than most recent presidents simply because he's been in Washington and in the Congress, right? He's not been he's not coming from out of town as a governor who doesn't know his way down Pennsylvania Avenue. So I think, there's a lot of repair to be done here. There's a very difficult governing culture. There's a lot of bad blood. There's a lot of distrust. And if you thought that having a bunch of people over for the Super Bowl or for cocktails or for going down to the Capitol and sitting in a room was going to get you the capital you needed to overhaul the entire federal budget and stimulate the economy with bipartisan support, I think you would have been fantasizing a bit. But if your idea is that by doing this gradually over time, by showing goodwill, by keeping your word, by not personalizing it, by not getting furious and shutting people out because they don't vote for your program, that over time you can actually get some stuff done in a two-party way and in a civil way, I think that's still a scenario that's very much alive. And I think he's right to believe that even if he can pass things without them, the country will be more accepting, and he will get wider latitude if he can change the culture of governing. Mm.
I guess the question, Matt, though, is there time? We're seeing horrendous numbers of people losing their jobs day by day in this country. It seems pretty dramatic.
Well, he's going to get the stimulus done. He doesn't need Republican support to do that. So, sure, there's time. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not the time factor of passing this legislation isn't going to change if he has Republican votes or if he doesn't. They're going to pass it anyway. But I think, I think all of his outreach and the kind words on both sides and the sort of, the nature of the debate, at least to this point, is going to make people a little more hopeful and a little more confident about government. And ultimately, because there are some very, as Obama has said, there are some very hard decisions we're going to have to make. They just got harder as a result of this pending stimulus bill. And I think ultimately it's going to be easier for him to build consensus by laying that groundwork now. So I think he is looking in a longer term way at this, which has been sort of his hallmark as a candidate and as laying out his vision for the country, and which frankly I think is a sharp departure from the last, from the last 20 years or so of never looking more than a couple of weeks and a couple of polls ahead.
What do you make of his executive orders so far? Have they been meaningful?
Well, they're very, very meaningful to his base, and they're meaningful from a policy perspective. I mean, look, as has been talked about by many, many people who've looked at it more closely than I have, President Bush governed in part with executive orders. He governed in part by consolidating executive power and making as many moves and changes of significance as he could without having to go through a Congress, particularly in the last couple of years when he didn't have a Congress of his own party. So, I think it was incumbent on any Democratic president who wanted to change those policies to revisit some of them. I think the Guantanamo thing is very, very significant, even if it takes a while, because it goes directly to the heart of this question of whether we are, in fact, fighting a war or not, and whether we have criminals in prison or whether we have enemy combatants in prison. All of these questions need to be reexamined in a fundamental way, and I think he's doing that. And I think, he signed a bunch of stuff that is very, very meaningful to people who've been waiting a long time and who've invested a lot of faith in him.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about policy prescriptions and his needing to be careful that they're not stuck in the past. Are there any policy prescriptions from the past that would inform the future and are pertinent to now?
Well, many, I'm sure, and you see a lot of them in this bill. I mean, there is a bunch of money for infrastructure, and that probably makes a lot of sense because you can do some of it quickly, and we certainly need some of it. And so that comes, you know, directly from sort of a New Deal model. And the middle-class tax cuts that he'd like to get through, easing, you know, some money there, that comes, you know, directly from sort of, well, many presidents, but President Kennedy in particular. And you know, the tax reform he's talking about, you know, you could trace the last tax reform we really did was for Ronald Reagan and a Democratic Congress in the 1980s. So there's a lot in these historical analogies we're talking about that pertains to this. But I think there's a problem in looking at it too literally. As I say, you know, the problem in the 1930s was significantly different. When you have a quarter of your workforce out of work,
sure,
it makes a ton of sense. In an economy, by the way, that's completely driven by craftsmen and a burgeoning industrial economy, that is, you know, by largely unskilled labor or very specially skilled labor, then, you know, it makes a lot of sense to go out and build a ton of bridges and tunnels and roads. And by the way, you had a great need for them because the driving part of the country was brand new, and you also had no federal outlay, really no huge government or deficit, so spending on it was not a big deal. This is an entirely different moment. We don't have that kind of towering unemployment. We are looking at a service economy and a digital economy much more than we're looking at industrial economy. It's not clear that you could actually save the economy by propping up the sectors that build physical infrastructure. We do have a huge looming problem budgetarily, because we have these structural deficits, and now we're reaching a point that a couple years ago would have been absolutely unthinkable on the debt level. So, for a variety of reasons, it's not you know exactly analogous. And I think people who think hard about this, and economists who looked at it carefully, are kind of quietly saying, if you talk to them, you know, that this stimulus bill is probably a great first step in a lot of directions, but very imperfect.
We're going to welcome phone calls from Matt. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Monday morning at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Matt is a writer for the New York Times Magazine, very savvy political guy, author of The Argument, Inside the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, and did a superb job in covering the 2008 presidential election. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I think a good portion of this hour we'll be talking about the economic stimulus bill and about this spirit of bipartisanship, whether or not this is a new time for a new president, that there's not really an especially useful historical parallel for what Obama seeks to achieve. And so there's something new, informed by the past, of course, but very much 2009. To your phone calls in a moment. Tina Brown joining us the second half hour for All Things Political. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second of our program this Monday, we'll take a look at population in the world and whether or not overpopulation is creating significant problems for all of us who live on Earth. Okay, let's go to phone calls for Matt Bai, and we start with Charles from Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. It seems to me that we're going to pour all kind of taxpayer money into business, that we should require that the business hire Americans and not send the jobs overseas. How about that?
How about that, Matt?
Well, it's pretty elegant, and it makes a lot of sense, Charles. I think, you know, I think what business people would tell you, or people who study the economic sector, is that, well, if we're going to pour money into business, the priority is that business prosper, so that it hires more people and you know, increases its bottom line and adds money into the economy, and businesses prosper in lots of different ways. So I don't know how strictly you want to limit them in terms of who they can hire and where they can work. I do think there's some consensus that businesses ought not to benefit on a tax level or on a policy level from taking jobs and moving them overseas.
Thank you, Charles, for your call. We go to Jim from Oconomowoc. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. I have a question for your guest, and that is, you know, the Republicans have a block, and they're saying, we're not going to vote for this TARP package, but the economic reconstruction package in the United States. And I'm wondering if this is a Rush Limbaugh-esque type of strategy that is really kind of a last-ditch effort by the Republicans to say, look, we can say, are you better off in 6 months? And almost assuredly, people in the United States are probably not going to be better off in 6 months. And then, you know, in the process of that happening, if it happens, they can say, well, we voted against all this. Now we're more viable. Now we're back as being the conservative Republican group that can save you, the Americans, from this terrible disaster that is still impending. Or do you think that they are, this is just a brief show, and that eventually Obama will win them over and we will have more cooperative governance here in the United States? And I'll take my answer off.
Thanks, Jim. Great question.
Thanks, Jim. It's a lot of questions. I look at this a little less conspiratorially. No, I don't think this is a Rush Limbaugh thing. I don't think this is, you know, I know the examples you're thinking of in the past. I don't think this is a case of Republicans trying to game the system so that they can pull some political advantage. I think they're looking at sort of, you know, barely getting back on their feet right now as opposed to getting back in a majority. But, you know, what I think is going on here is pretty straightforward. I think they have philosophical differences over how the package is being constructed. They simply believe, as a party, and that you would stimulate the economy better through giving people back money and tax cuts, putting it in their pocket, than you would by having government spend it. They're suspicious of government. They don't think government can spend it well. And the political, so they're against, you know, the basic frame of the package, even though they got some. They got some concessions, and politically, I think their thinking, their hope, is that they can oppose the package without being seen as in staunch opposition to President Obama. That they can retain a civil, good relationship with Obama, and meanwhile cast themselves as a more workable opposition to congressional Democrats who have much lower approval ratings and who they will paint as being sort of profligate and overly liberal. I think it's also worth, you know, pointing out that there is a difference. We've forgotten, it's been so long since we had any kind of cooperative bipartisan government, and I don't know if we'll have one now, that we've sort of forgotten about what this terminology means. It's not necessarily uncooperative or overly partisan to vote against a package as a party. That's okay. That's happened throughout American history. If you want to vote against, if your party doesn't believe philosophically in a piece of legislation, I don't think anyone's going to begrudge you that. You take your chances with the voters. You go out, you make your case. If you lose, you lose. If you win, you win. I think the question is how you oppose it and whether it's philosophical or simply stylistic, and whether it's kind of a search and destroy mission, and whether you smear the opposition and or lower trust in government. And in this case, I think, you know, let's give the Republicans their due here. They've been very gracious about President Obama. They've been complimentary. They appreciated him coming down and meeting with them. They have philosophical differences on the package, and that is called government, and I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm. There are some, though, I don't want to spend a lot of time on Rush Limbaugh, but there are some who are saying that a lot of Republicans are living in fear of this guy who publicly has stated that he hopes Obama fails, and, you know, they have to get on his show and amend what they said about criticism of Rush for saying that kind of thing. The guy has a lot of power, I think.
Yeah, I think he does too, but I think you have to put it in perspective. I mean, look, everybody lives in fear of their base, Democrats and Republicans both. But, you know, at the same time, they've been so beat up. I mean, they've been following that line for a decade or more. And at this point, they're so beat up and discredited. I mean, just look at who they elected to the Republican National Chairmanship. I mean, not only is Michael Steele African-American with very little Washington experience, there's a real question about whether he's pro-choice. I can't quite figure it out, but he at least was pro-choice and may well still be. I mean, this signals, I think, that Republicans are ready to go, for the moment, in a different direction. There may come a time where Rush Limbaugh is their chief concern again, but I don't think that's where the fear is right now. The fear is being marginalized. Marginalized in a society where the voters want something different and are changing and have a different set of fears, and all they're doing is following their base off the cliff. So I think there's actually a different mood right now in the Republican Party.
Gary from Glendale is next. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Matt.
Hi.
I would like to add a couple of components to your declaration that Obama says he's overstating the issues he's facing. For one thing, the foreign policy crises you have overlooked. The occupation of Iraq, the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan are off the budget page and certainly adding to the deficit. And, you know, the economic crisis is far worse than what Reagan based coming in. So I think you have to consider these factors in the whole picture, that he has an unprecedented combination of domestic economic issues facing plus unprecedented foreign policy issues that are costing money, lives, and are difficult to solve.
Well, I think you got a point, Gary. I think I would term those challenges, as opposed to saying they're obviously worse or deeper or unprecedented, I would say they're different. I mean, you know, it would take a better historian than I to talk about, you know, to really contrast and compare, say, the early 1980s to now. But I think, you know, in this case, obviously we're facing insolvency with banks, and as you say, we have these huge expenditures. I mean, we're now going over 10% of the gross domestic product in debt, which is, you know, huge. I mean, a couple of years ago we were talking about 2.5%. You know, could people abide 2.5%? I mean, now we're talking about 10%. But at the same time, you know, in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan came in, if you wanted to buy a house, if you were paying what interest rates reached 18%, inflation was, you know, out of control. People couldn't afford anything. I mean, there was, you know, a different set of challenges that, you know, were awfully difficult at that time. So, you know, I think we certainly face bigger structural challenges than previous generations have faced, in terms of these aren't quick crises. These are major structural budget problems that we are going to have to address, and structural problems internationally. That is, what kind of threat are we facing, and how do we go about facing it? But these are, you know, this is, as Obama said in his inauguration speech, time to put away childish things. I mean, these are 20, 30-year decisions that a generation of baby boomer leadership in this country simply failed to address. So it's not as if we're facing a sort of sudden flashpoint that's so much worse than what anyone else in history has faced. I think we're actually facing an abdication of responsibility and a failure to make decisions over a long period of time that is probably less responsible than what other generation of Americans have presented to their children. And in that sense, perhaps it is a worse crisis.
Mm-hmm. One more call for Matt. Let's go to Bill from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Wonderful, wonderful show. Great article.
Thanks,
Bill. 2 points. Two points. You sound so young, too. Well, anyway.
I think he is young.
That's unfair.
Anyway, I'm 17, Bill.
You have more activity than we do, having lived through all that last 50 years. 2 points. One is about when people gave cash rebates, when the government gave a tax rebate recently, I think Martin Feldstein, another more conservative economist, which I usually don't follow, but said that a lot of people just put it in the bank, and the banks, you know, can invest in other things, but they're certainly not doing that now.
Right.
Loans are very hard to get for small industry and other people. And Feldstein thought, I mean, and you presented the infrastructure more with the highway analogy from Eisenhower, if I recall. I was just turning on the radio. And I think the kind of infrastructure that people are talking now goes well beyond that. I mean, it's the highway system, not the internet, but it was the highway system of, you know, this century, or the beginning of this decade, the end of it, of, you know, improving schools, the infrastructure, giving them the things to train people and get better schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's to fix energy waste in federal buildings of all places and other things. It's for research on these things that are going forward and that may result in new industry, may.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also to put money in the hands of people that can then pay taxes to the states that are, you know, I mean, by employing them to the states that are having real deficits to fund schools and medical plans. So, anyway, I just throw that out as I voted for Martin Feldstein for
Bill. Bill, you raise a great point here, which I think is really the overarching point I would have here, and my overarching criticism of the process, if I have one, over the last couple of weeks, which is, we're talking actually about a couple different things here, which is why it's hard for people to get their head around this and have a conversation about it. We're talking about three things, really. We're talking about stimulus, right? And that's easy. It's like that's not easy to do, but it's easy to envision, right? That's putting money into things that in the next 18 months, let's say, are going to spur jobs and suppliers and the economy. And then there's long-term investment, which is some of the stuff you're talking about, right? These decisions I'm talking about for 30 years that have not actually been addressed. We need schools. We need broadband. Very, very, you know, badly in the country if we're going to compete long-term. We have new infrastructure needs, electric grid, power grids, I mean, all this kind of stuff. Healthcare would come under this category for me. Education, building schools, all the things that we've not dealt with that, you know, are probably in investments in a future that will pay themselves back, but not necessarily short term. And then you really have tax reform and entitlement reform, which you also touched on, right? Then there's a question, is the tax code fair? Is it sustainable? Are we able to sustain the federal budget obligations that we have under the tax code we have? Obviously, the entitlement situation, there's a piece on this today. I was just seeing in the Washington Post. We're going to have to deal with entitlements, but we've been saying this for 20 years and haven't done it. These are different things. And if I have a criticism and a concern, it's that I understand the temptation that President Obama and the lawmakers have had here, which is we've got a blank check. People believe we need stimulus. Let's throw as much of this pile of stuff under stimulus as we can and get it out the door, because it's really, really hard to pass spending programs, and it's only going to get harder after we pass all this stimulus money. As opposed to saying, I think, which would have been a more intellectually honest and long-term viable conversation, just say we've got these three things, and let's break them out. Let's do stimulus. Let's talk about long-term investment that we have failed to make for 30 years, and then let's figure out how to get our budget in order to sustain these things, and that's going to require some sacrifice. That would be a harder legislative and intellectual road to take, but it would be more candid and ultimately would give people, I think, a much clearer sense of the depth and the variation of the problems we actually face right now. Hmm.
Thanks so much, Bill, for the call. Stay on the line, everybody. Your calls will still be applicable for Tina Brown. Matt, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure.
Anytime, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Matt, by his piece in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, Don't Look Back, Why Obama is Not FDR or Kennedy or Lincoln or History. He's also the author of The Argument, Inside the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. We thank him for being with us for the first half hour of All Things Political. Tina Brown joining us the second half hour. Phone lines are still welcome as we talk about economic stimulus, and we have to spend more time on Michael Steele, too. And Tom Daschle, who's facing some tax problems. We got to talk about all of that. And here is how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Tina Brown is the founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, which I'm sure many of you go to fairly regularly on your computers. She's the author of the 2007 New York Times bestseller, The Diana Chronicles, and has written for a number of publications, including The Times of London, The Spectator, and The Washington Post. She's the author of two plays, Under the Bamboo Tree, and her journalism, and Happy Yellow, and her journalism career began in 73, writing for the London Sunday Times. She joins us now, our number continuing to be 800-486-8655. And Tina Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Let's talk about all this money that's floating around. You've written about private planes are becoming a thing of the past. Have the titans of Wall Street thought about taking the train? I don't know. Are we going to see a whole culture shift here or not?
Well, it's very interesting. What was rather funny was on Saturday night, actually, I was at dinner, and Richard Parsons was there, the new chairman of Citibank and Citicorp, and he took the train, you know, for his last meeting with the president last week. But you know what happened, which people didn't seem to know, was that his train broke down in New Jersey, and he didn't get to the meeting. He missed the meeting.
No. Oh, no.
So, I mean, you know, in a way, it was like an advertisement for why CEOs need planes.
But do they need planes that cost $50 million or however
they
much
sure
it
don't.
Is?
They sure do. You know, what's absolutely incredible to me today is to actually see, you know, Sandy Weill, the former chairman of the bank, you know, saying that, you know, he wasn't now going to take the private plane. Although he left, you know, 6 years ago, and the last time he took the plane was at Christmas to go to Mexico. And it was like, did he not get the memo before Christmas? Like, what is it, as Claire McCaskill said memorably last week, I mean, which planet are they on?
Exactly. And also memorably, they shouldn't make any more money than the president. $400,000, if we're bailing you out, that's it. What do you think of that?
Well, it is pretty extraordinary. I think the thing is that they have lived in this entirely other universe. And obviously, you know, we're all kind of in favor of you make a lot of money, you get a crack of it. But of course, what's been happening is that this money has been invisible. It has been, in fact, not. I mean, you know, when you actually, it's fine if you make the money, but if you don't, you know, if in fact it all goes horribly sour, then why are you getting the same cut? You know, it's extraordinary, really.
Mm-hmm. It is extraordinary. What do you make of the stimulus bill moving through the House debate in the Senate today? What do you think we're going to get here?
Well, I do think that the bill is a very unsatisfactory bill. You know, I was in Washington on Saturday night at that, you know, alfalfa.
Oh, did you go to that party?
Oh, I did indeed. Oh. And it was, and actually the feeling in the room there was very sort of anti that bill across the board, bipartisan.
Really?
I think that people feel it isn't really focusing enough on the stimulus itself, and that it has been sort of overstuffed with other pieces of social engineering, which at this moment are not what we should be focusing on. So I don't think the bill is a terrific bill, but I think it will get amended. And it's very interesting. We have a good piece today by John Avlin on the Daily Beast about McCain's new role. And McCain is really becoming, has really become the de facto leader of the opposition, and he is very, very strongly opposed to this bailout, and I think he's going to take a real leadership role this week.
Mm-hmm. So the problem is the money that's going for infrastructure and not going for tax relief, or not enough infrastructure. What's the problem here?
Well, I think that people are feeling that there's not enough really on dealing with the mortgage crisis itself. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's not enough, and that the new bailout is going to, the new stimulus package will in fact try to address the mortgages issue in far more detail. You know, what I think what he wants to, he's just opposed McCain, you know, to the $150 million for the Smithsonian, the $400 million for sexually transmitted diseases, you know, the $6 million for broadband internet access. These are all things which are really nothing to do with a need for a stimulus package, and they have to be taken out of there.
Mm-hmm. Frank Rich had an interesting column yesterday in which he talked about, you think you got problems with the stimulus package, wait until we look at the bills to prevent the collapse of America's banks, which may be even more problematic. And he cites Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and how he didn't do his job earlier with the New York Fed. I'm wondering a couple things here. What about that? What's coming up? And number two is, do you think that, you know, we're supposed to have this era of bipartisanship, that people are going to be able to fashion something that is going to help all the people who are out of work in this country, the bridges that need fixing? We got a serious crisis here. We don't want people dilly-dallying.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think actually that McCain is going to be helpful on this. I mean, he wants to refocus on the foreclosures and the ongoing mortgage crisis and revive the late-inning campaign proposal for the government, you know, to buy up the loans from underwater homeowners and renegotiate more affordable terms, which I think is important. I mean, on the banks, I think that, you know, of course, there's been a huge amount about the bonuses and the planes, and in a way, they've become sort of the stand-ins for the real problem, which is that these banks have just been too big. I mean, these forced shotgun mergers and these huge kind of behemoths that they've created has just not worked. And I mean, I must say that what I'd like to see is that in the new sort of era of banking, that somehow they figure out a way to kind of make the structure of these banks less completely unwieldy and less lacking in accountability. I mean, it was one of the most amazing things that, you know, Robert Rubin at Citicorp, you know, he was there and he said, well, I have no online responsibility, and yet he participated in every one of these decisions, you know, that caused the meltdown in that bank. And it walked away with the most amazing bonuses. And
right.
You just sort of think, well, at what point are the people in charge going to figure out how, you know, the fact that we want them to be accountable and we want them to feel the personal responsibility that they should feel with this bailout coming their way.
And the other question which remains, Tina, is what the heck has happened to all the money we've already given them? Where is it?
Well, you know, the thing is that what I think is rather disgraceful is that they're not actually, I mean, they were supposed to be loaning the money. This was supposed to speed up, you know, the credit loans to other people, but they're not doing it. They've been actually hoarding it. And that, I think, is really appalling that you know, the money has been given to them, but they're still not giving the loans to the small businesses that they should. So, you know, partly I think that some of the kind of shaming of the bankers in a way has been useful in that, you know, when Obama sort of wagged his finger and said, you know, we just can't have any more of this kind of squandering. I think it is really important because, as we saw with the behavior of Sandy Weill just at Christmas, it just seems that you really have to drill it home to them. This is a new era where this money isn't theirs anymore. This money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it ever was, but I mean, this money is now the taxpayers' money, and they have to have accountability, and there has to be constraints put in there by Congress to show that that the taxpayers are in fact being protected with a seat on the board and with real accountability, rather than just letting them have the money to do what they want with.
Yeah, exactly. So, who was funny at the dinner? Was the president funny?
You know, they were all really hilarious, actually, I have to say. I mean, the speeches were hysterical. Obama himself was really witty, you know. I mean, the first thing he said was, I thought that torture had been outlawed. and he kind of went on in that vein. It was, you know, he said that, you know, that the dinner was actually founded to celebrate the birthday of General Robert E. Lee, and Obama said if he were here with us tonight, the general would be 202 years old and very confused. But actually, you know, it did point up the kind of rather wonderful thing that, you know, in the 70s, African Americans weren't even allowed in this dinner, which is the kind of height of sort of pompous, self-congratulatory sort of, you know, Washington establishment all slapping each other on the back. And here we are, you know, only 30 years later, and it's not just that African Americans, of course, are now absolutely participating in this dinner in every way, but we have an African American president who, you know, who is presiding. And that says something wonderful about America. And it also says, in a way, why we should be all so hopeful and positive about the next era, because even though it's horrible at the moment and it's really hard to see how we're going to get out of this mess, you know, America does have a wonderful ability to reinvent itself quickly. And I will say that even these horrible kind of banking situations, you know, the financial people are, there are a lot of smart people there. I mean, they've got off course, of course. But, you know, we have a good piece today by Charlie Gasparino, our business writer, who was the guy who actually exposed in the Daily Beast John Thain's appalling $1 million or whatever it was he spent on his office, where, you know, he had a $87,000 rug and so on. And, you know, that hue and cry was begun by Charlie. But even Charlie says today that, you know, the time for just attacking and bashing the banks, yes, we've got to keep them on track. Yes, we have to drill in the fact that they cannot be behaving in the way they have. But there's also a lot of very smart people on Wall Street, and we have to be able to let the very smart people also very much participate in the reinvention of this of this period, because otherwise, you know, we're going to, people in government must oversee, but they also aren't necessarily going to be, you know, as financially as smart about a reinvention as some of these people on Wall Street, in fact, can be if they just apply their minds to it.
Tina Brown is with us for this segment of All Things Political. We'll take your phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is the number on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tina Brown, our guest right now, founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and we go to phone calls starting with John from Superior. Hi, John.
Good morning. I wanted to ask your guest about accountability, and President Obama said that this bill does not have any pork or earmarks. He will not allow it. Be a transparent process, but I'm curious, maybe this is just semantics, because when I start to look at some of the detail, and it is available online, I see some of these expenditures that don't seem like they're really for job creation, and I wanted clarification about what is an earmark, what is pork, and is President Obama just playing with semantics and saying that there isn't any in the stimulus bill?
Well, you know, of course, the president himself has to deal with the sort of more lefter aspect of his own party. And, you know, in fact, it's quite interesting, because when the House Republicans were talking, we have an interesting report on that by John Batchelor on the Daily Beast. He said one of the Republicans said off the record, you know, that when the president came to visit them, the president was patient. He gave us plenty of time, but he didn't convince anybody. After he left, we looked at each other and said, how can they stick him with this garbage? I think you're going to see a lot of amendments to this bill. And the only thing one can ask is, well, why did Obama sort of let some of this pork get in? And I think, you know, he has himself his own political issues. You know, I mean, we can't, you know, he's not a guy who can operate by fiat and edict himself. He has to work with persuasion. And he has to persuade his own kind of Nancy Pelosi wing just as much as he has to work with persuading the Republicans. So he's got a complicated issue, really, and he's trying to balance it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Well, first off, I just point out that, you know, people criticize the government, but as the late George Carlin pointed out, you know, we're the government. We voted for this, collectively at least, and we tolerated all of the things that happened that brought us to this point. Yes, the bankers are smart, but that doesn't mean they're ethical. And from my point of view, we ought to nationalize them and really get some control and really exert some control over them. And the final point that I want to make is that I think the most important book of the year, which really summarizes where the conservatives are at, is Thomas Frank's new book, The Wrecking Crew,
yep.
How Conservatives Rule. Because, you know, they not only during Reagan did Stockman implement a deliberate deficit, but the same thing has just happened to us a second time. And we're paying for it.
Well, it is really horrible. I mean, one of the things that is, you know, scary, though, is that the fact is that, you know, nationalizing it are you as confident, I'm not really, that a nationalized bank is necessarily going to function efficiently either? I mean, I think we often feel that when a government does get into running things, they don't run very well either. So it's almost as if you need to have greater government restraints and yet have the ability to still, you know, have the bankers, you know, the smarter ones, the more ethical ones, running this stuff with a really kind of firm clamping hand and a very vigilant overseeing SEC, because the SEC have been a disgrace in this whole affair. I mean, the laxity and so forth. The problem was that things were doing so well that it became just a joyride for everybody. And I think, you know, we've seen throughout the last kind of 10 years, whether it was Enron or whether it was kind of the con man Bernie Madoff, or whether in fact it's the banks. It's the trouble is that when the money is loosed and fast and everybody's making it, nobody's really wanting to call to blow the whistle.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little more time on ethical government, which I think a lot of us are longing for, and it's problematic in both parties. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about Tom Daschle, whether or not he's going to be confirmed, or is that back tax issue going to be really a big deal for him? And we've got Geithner as well, who had a back tax problem. What's everybody thinking here? What are they thinking?
Well, I'll tell you something that I think. I'm very troubled by it, and I don't think Geithner should have been confirmed, actually, with that back tax issue. I think that it was very sloppy, and what worried me, really, was the fact that, you know, here we have a situation where for the last kind of 5 years, the so-called attention to detail about money has been really what's got us into this problem, with everybody just playing fast and loose and dealing with money in brushstrokes and not actually really caring where it all went. And if we now have a Secretary of the Treasury who was also kind of sloppy about the detail of money, that actually troubles me. Mm-hmm. So I was actually not in great favor of Geithner being confirmed. And actually, I think that Tom Daschle's story is pretty sloppy. I think that he also has rather infuriated, what I hear is that he's very much infuriated the Obama administration, because at least Geithner came clean and told them his issues so that they could kind of deal with them and work through them. But in the case of Daschle, he actually didn't tell them. And as a result, they've all been caught on one foot with it and feel embarrassed. So it's a problem. And I think that it's all part of our era where people just think the details of ethics and the details of honesty just seem to be regarded as a bit of a waste of time. And I'd like to feel that that's going to change now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Bill from Madison is next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Since the first round of stimulus was intended to, loosen up credit markets primarily, as well as, you know, help with distressed mortgage debt, et cetera, and none of that has happened so far, essentially they've just gotten free money. Before they get the second round or, you know, a penny more, I would like to see them pass a nationwide anti-usury laws. For example, banks are all set up in Delaware and South Dakota to avoid having to have any limits on how much interest they can charge, how many fees they can charge for consumers. But I'd like to see go back to the days where they were usury laws, and instead of... Since the Supreme Court made a decision that made it impossible to enforce outside of one state, make it a national usury law situation. So that if the banks won't agree to it, fine. Don't give them another penny.
I think that's actually very smart. I think that one of the things that's been particularly awful about the last month or two is the way they got the money and then just hoarded it, as you know, and. There has to be some, I mean, what absolutely cannot happen, and I think everybody's feeling this, and certainly they do, I know that that's how they're feeling on the GOP side, that you simply cannot just give these guys the money and expect them to do the right thing. That has been quite clearly proven that they haven't. And what's happened, I think, is that people don't believe it is going to happen either. So there's a kind of paralysis that's settled in, because there is such a lack of confidence in the fact that these banks will behave in the right way that people are sort of, they say, well, listen, I mean, this may have happened, but we're not going to go with it. We're just going to stay right here. And we're just going to hoard our money, and we're just going to just, we don't want to be involved with the new situation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go back for a moment to other cabinet appointments. You said you had problems with Geithner and with Daschle. Other appointments particularly, you feel particularly strongly about, happy about, not happy about?
I think Larry Summers is a great person to be running the Economic Council, although, of course, you know, he's in the past, he's also been involved with some of the sort of loosening of regulations that we see as a problem now. But he is a very brilliant guy, and I think he's a good choice. I think that Hillary Clinton is an inspired choice to be Secretary of State. You know, she's got the profile overseas. She has the experience. And I think she's, and actually in this instance, although nobody likes to say it and they kind of pretend it's a problem, I think that the presence of Bill Clinton in her life actually is an immense good thing. I mean, apparently in Davos, he was meeting all the time with foreign leaders. And clearly what he's doing is he's doing a lot of backstage warming up of American policies without being public about it, which I think is, in fact, a great thing for her. I think her issue that she's slightly got to deal with is that all these envoys are being appointed as well, people mm-hmm. like Richard Holbrooke for Pakistan and Afghanistan and George Mitchell for the Middle East. And how that kind of new structure is going to be administered has, I think, some thorny aspects, because you could have a lot of very high-powered people wheeling around kind of somewhat competing with each other for turf, which I think is a problem, or could be a problem anyway. So she's got quite a kind of delicate management issue, I think, as Secretary of State. But I am very confident that she'll do a good job there.
Mm-hmm. Scott from Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I was just curious as to your take on the stimulus package, which really seems to have a lot of stuff in it that will not stimulate any growth at all in the economy. And I'm wondering if Barack's going to, like you said before he was elected, go through the budget line by line, because this really seems to be more of a budget / spending bill than it is a stimulus bill. There's billions of dollars in it that will not stimulate the economy at all, and I just think it's a horrible situation we're in right now.
Well, I think that's very, very true. And I mean, how he now confronts this and how much he's willing to see it altered is going to be a kind of early test of his muscle, I think, as a president. And how he, you know, I think there's no doubt here, as I say, that John McCain is going to be very important here. He's not going to roll over. He's got nothing to lose. You know, he's not running for president anymore. And you know, he's added the you know, he's got the added weight of a party mantle around his neck, and he's got nothing to prove. So I think McCain is going to be leading the charge, and how he and Obama sort of deal. I think there'll be quite a bit of personal dealing going on. I think that Rahm Emanuel, who basically oversaw the bringing of this bill sort of to birth with the Democrats, has not done a great job so far. I think that he's, you know, assumed that the Republicans would simply go for it because they have such leverage now with the public. But it hasn't happened. Interestingly enough, the Republicans have shown a lot of discipline in hanging together on it.
Mm-hmm. Except when you look at the Republican governors who would like to have the money in their states hurting so badly, and they're lobbying for the bill, aren't they? Many of them are.
They are. A lot of them are. I mean, you know, that's the question. It's very interesting that there's Obama sort of watching the Super Bowl yesterday with, you know, a lot of Republicans were there, too. He's working overtime, I think, to co-opt as many people as he can.
Right. Thanks for the call, Scott. Let's go to Kevin from Rice Lake. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question as far as the GOP. I've heard them complain about wanting more tax breaks. And from what I understand, America has the largest corporate tax in the world. And they're sitting here complaining about wanting more tax breaks, but these guys have, you know, a lot of their finances in foreign soil. They're paying lower wages and stuff like that, overseas employees. If they want to get these tax breaks for corporate America, I feel they should, you know, bring them back home. Bring them back to our soil, be transparent in their, you know, finances and what's going on, so that they can actually take advantage of the tax breaks that they will be receiving. But it seems a little excessive. You're paying less in wages, you're not transparent in where your money's going, and they want taxes on top of that, tax breaks on top of that.
All right, Kevin, thank you. Tina?
Well, you know, I think that this has become a whole issue all by itself, and the question is how much of an airing is it going to get as this rush to get this bill through, you know, is aired. There are so many different issues that are spiraling out of it, and, you know, it's all about sort of railroading it through as fast as it can. I mean, and the question is how long have we got to debate it before, you know, any more of the big hiatuses while a kind of stalemate happens aren't going to help America.
Mm-hmm. How long do we have to debate it, do you think?
I think it'll be done, you know, I think it's going to be fast. I cannot imagine that this thing can go on. I mean, people are so panicked, and as the market continues to sort of, as the economy continues to sort of falter. I mean, every time a bank releases its earnings, it's absolutely worse than it was the last time we heard from it. So, I mean, in that sense, the leverage, I suppose, there is with the Democrats.
Yeah. One more phone call. We're running short on time, everybody. Eric is next from Woodruff. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, the vast majority of the people in the United States are employed by small business owners. I'm hearing nothing politically or in the economic stimulus package about what's going to be done to support small business owners. Define that as companies that employ less than 100 people.
Okay.
Well, this again is what is the banks have got to be persuaded to lend to these people, and I think there has to be a campaign to do it. They've really been the ones who I think the small businesses have been the ones who've been hit the hardest by all that's going on. I mean, they just haven't. They're just sitting there without anything being done, and the banks seem to be unable to sort of get their own acts together or their own willingness to lend. So I think that we need to hear more campaigning about it, and I think that we should all be very noisy in our sort of desire to get the small businessman the support that they need.
Mm-hmm. Tina, thank you so much for being with us. I really love the work you do. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Tina Brown, founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, a website that if you haven't been to, it's very good. Tina, dailybeast.com, author of the 2007 New York Times bestseller, The Diana Chronicles, and former editor of Tattler, Vanity Fair, New Yorker, and Talk magazines, and host of CNBC's Topic A with Tina Brown. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee at the Royce Federal Plaza. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll, of course, return with more Monday Conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.